You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, February 28th, 2018, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Tally-ho, everyone.
Kara is on assignment this week, but she'll be back next week. But we have some exciting news. Are you guys ready for exciting news?
I'm sitting down.
Always.
I'm ready.
Well, guys, you know internally at the SGU for the last month I've been working on our Patreon account. Well, I finally finished it, and the Patreon account is now live. So our plan with this Patreon account is not to get rid of our existing membership, but for those people who want to engage with the SGU, you could come over to the Patreon account, and you'll see that we have a lot of really awesome things that we can and could only deliver through the Patreon account. We can't do it with our existing membership because it's much older technology.
Yeah, people were asking us for more options in terms of like supporting the SGU, and a lot of people, I guess, like to use Patreon. So actually, we've been working with the people at Patreon. They like assigned people to us because I guess we're a big account for them, and we spent a long time like really tweaking it. The good thing is that, we're still going to keep the existing membership. If you're a member and you just want to continue being a member, you don't have to worry about anything. You don't have to do anything. Everything will continue the way it is. But there are some new options at the entry level. So the entry level for the Patreon membership starts at $5 because you get a lot more stuff. So let me go over really quickly. You'll get access to Patreon Lens, which is this new app they have where we could share video and do like all sorts of behind the scenes stuff. There's patron only content posts that we'll be putting up on the site. You'll be able to access community posts. You'll have access to a private SGU Discord server. Jay, you want to tell them about that?
Yeah, just think of the Discord server as it's like a series of chat rooms, like old style textual chat rooms where we might have rooms that are set up for certain topics. And then there's voice chat. So you as a Patreon patron of ours could talk to other people. And that's a place where we can establish the SGU community, which is something that we've been wanting to do for a long time, is just have our listeners have their own community. And then at higher levels, we will go into chat rooms with people. I think it starts at the $20 level. Once or twice a month, we'll go in and talk to people in the voice chat. But we're going to be on the Discord server all the time. And, I'm sure that spontaneously we'll get involved with conversations with people in real time.
Yeah. So at the premium level, the $8 level, that's the same. So again, we were trying to keep it as similar as possible to our existing membership. So at $8, and this is per month, we're not going to do anything per episode or anything. It's just going to be, everything's going to be per month. You still get the premium content. We're getting close to 100 pieces of premium content that we have uploaded. You'll get instant access to our entire backload of uncut interviews, extra segments from the show. So a few videos are there. We're producing new premium content all the time. Plus, you'll get access to ad-free versions of the show. And then because we're on Patreon and we have other options, you'll also get access to a monthly Q&A live stream. You'll be able to view it, and you'll be able to vote on which questions we address. And then at the at higher levels, at the $20 level, you'll be able to actually ask the questions. And then we have some higher levels still that you could take a look at. But the main levels are really like the $5 and the $8 level, where you get the ability basically to do all the interactive stuff on Patreon at the $5 level, and you get the premium content at the $8 level. And we have a lot of goals, like, depending on the number of patrons that we get. Go to the site. We'll have the link. It's patreon.com/skepticsguide. Look at our goals. Look at our membership rewards. We, of course, always appreciate it when you support the SGU. This will help us do more, and you'll see by the goals that we have set, some of the kind of stuff that we have to do. The one I had to kind of twist Jay's arm about, I don't think I've told Bob and Evan about it yet. At a certain level, we are going to do another marathon live streaming event.
All right.
Awesome. The question is, how long? Are we going to go for the 24 or make it human level 12 hours?
What do you think?
If history is any guide, Evan and I will be champs. We could again do the 24 hours without leaving and going to bed.
That sounds like a challenge.
No, but that's we'll it. But it's also going to be annoying. I think 12 hours is fine. 24 is just kind of like, what the hell? We could do it. You guys, of course, would have trouble. But I think 12 hours is like 10 to 12 hours. That's a sweet spot. You could start at 8 or 9 in the morning, have a full day of awesomeness, and then you could at least go to sleep after that huge marathon. But yeah, I vote for 10 to 12 hours.
Yeah, I mean, look, we did the 24-hour thing. Yes, it was a lot of fun. And I'll tell you, it was such a huge undertaking. The only thing that was bigger production-wise was – producing the Ock videos, and that took a year of my life. But I don't know about 24 hours, but I mean I'll do whatever everybody else wants to do, but I think Bob's right.
Let's get some feedback from our patrons. Mm-hmm. Right, we'll see what they say about it. I mean, it's, you know, this is a goal that we're setting for them, so whatever incentive they need, I'm willing to do what they say. I'm so curious.
I can't wait to hear.
So, but there's a couple other really practical goals in there. There's a lot of practical ones. Like we need lots of new equipment. That's all in there at different levels. I think the two other big ones that have the potential to like really transform the SGU. One is at some point, and Jay and I carefully calculated out what it would take to make this happen. Jay's going to work full time for the SGU.
That will be transformative. I'm telling you.
Well, this will be the first time we've had a full time person working for the show, because we all do this in our spare time in addition to our day jobs. And, you know, that's the most significant limit on what we can do on the content that we can produce on everything. It's our limiting factor. So that would be transformative, but you know, that takes resources. One of the highest level goals that we have is that we are going to create a pilot for a skeptically themed TV show. I've already gotten everybody to sort of agree in principle that we're going to do this, but, you know, as you may know, we've talked about this over the years. We've been trying, you know, to do a skeptical TV show, but it's really hard. We've had lots of nibbles. You know, we've actually filmed a pilot, a couple of pilots. But they always seem to just die at some level, because at the highest executive levels, they just don't want to take a chance on a new concept of a show like this. Or they want the creative control that we can't live with. And my approach has always been, listen, yeah, okay, sure, we'll film a pilot with you, but these are our requirements. Like, we are not going to say, hey, who knows? Maybe this, you know, the paranormal is real. Like, it's never going to happen. It's got to be, we already have a brand, you know, that is completely scientific, and we will not compromise that. And that seems to always be the deal breaker, you know, that we're not going to compromise on the science.
Which is disturbingly telling.
You know, but the difference between now and even when we shot the National Geographic pilots that we did, you know, the internet has changed things so much. You know, putting a show on TV, you know, quote unquote TV, what the hell does that even mean anymore? With all the streaming channels, and, you know, there, the opportunity to get something published on Amazon or Netflix, it's all there. I don't think it would be that hard. I think, you know, what we want to do, though, we want to produce content that's easy to digest, that people have access to. You know, people are digesting a lot of video streaming. I mean, that's what we do at night, especially in the United States. I mean, most people I know, we talk about, what'd you watch last night, right? I mean, that's what you always say to each other. I think having programming like our podcast, but on Netflix, as an example, you know, handling the topics that we discuss on the show could be really a great way, an amazingly strong way to get the word out, to get people introduced to critical thinking.
Yeah. So at lower levels, you know, we're going to produce our own videos, you know, just for our Facebook page and YouTube, right? That kind of, you know, on the internet videos. But at the high level, we want to try to break into legacy TV or something like that, or cable. Still a long shot, but if we have the funds to produce our own pilot, then we retain creative control. And I think that's what we're going to need to do. That's the bottom line.
Yep. That's what it boils down to.
Yeah. 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 So we're excited about this. This is a lot of potential for growing the SGU, for growing our community. We really want to make this not just about you know, giving us more resources to do more stuff, but also about growing the SGU as a community not just of scientific skeptics, but of people who, you know, who are interested in science and geek culture and critical thinking and, you know, like the show and, you know, take the similar kind of approach to it all that we do. And, you know what I mean? And this, the, what we really like about Patreon is that they've really been developing their infrastructure. You know, the last time I looked at it, like a couple of years ago, it was kind of basic. Now they really have a lot of options
for
different ways of interacting, you know, with our patrons. And I think it's only going to get better. You know, they just have to just keep adding plugins and then we get new ways of producing content for you all and interacting with you all. And it's, I think it's going to be, turn out to be a really good option. Hey, Jay, you know what?
Yeah.
So the site went live today as we're recording this on Wednesday.
That's right.
We haven't announced it on social media yet. And of course the show is coming out on Saturday, but we already have one patron.
Hey,
awesome. Hey, we are off to the races.
Did mom do it? Mom did it, huh?
Yeah, so again, patreon.com/skepticsguide is the link that you need. We'll have that on Skeptics our homepage guide. And in the show notes. Yeah, Skeptics Guide.
And at the very least, go to the page and look at the video that Steve and I made.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah, it's funny.
Hey, and while we're making announcements, guys, we have a save the date for Nexus 2018, July 12th to 15th. July 12 to 15. We're diligently working on putting an excellent speakers lineup there for you. We have some fresh blood working with us this year. We're really excited about it. It's going to be in New York City again at the Fashion Institute of Technology, where we've been for the last few years. Hopefully there won't be any fires the day before our conference starts.
Nope, we met that quota already.
So we'll be giving you more information as it firms up, but that date is locked in. So July 12th to 15th. Do it. If you haven't been to Nexus before, it's a great conference.
And this will be our 10th anniversary of Nexus.
This is 10.
So
that's a round number.
This is special.
All right, Bob, get us started with a forgotten superhero of science.
All right. So for this week's Forgotten Superheroes of Science, I'm covering Margaret Oakley Dayhoff, 1925 to 1986. She was a pioneer in the application of computational techniques to proteins and nucleic acids. Many consider her the founder of bioinformatics.
Oh, wow. Bioinformatics.
Yeah. Look that word up. Dayhoff began her PhD work in quantum chemistry. Have you even heard of quantum chemistry? But it's essentially when the intermingling of experimental and theoretical methods in chemistry. So no real, you know, magic there. It kind of makes sense. But a half a century ago, Dayhoff actually worked with Carl Sagan on thermodynamic models of pre-biological atmospheres. How cool was that? But then in 1966, she was the first to use computers to compare protein sequences and infer their evolutionary histories. The one of the first to do that. But the apotheosis of her career, though, was arguably the book Atlas of Protein Sequence and Structure in 1965. This listed all known protein sequences. I think at that time it was like 65. Basically, it was the first attempt at revealing our proteome, right, Steve? I mean, that was really one of the first baby steps for showing what the proteome is all about. This book went through many editions and evolved into the Protein Information Resource Database of protein sequences. That was the first one ever that was online and remotely accessible. The first such database that was accessible, you know, from a half a planet away. Amazing. So for this and more reasons, the director of the National Center of Biotechnology Information, David Lippmann, called Dayhoff the mother and father of bioinformatics. So remember Margaret Oakley Dayhoff. Mention her to your friends, perhaps when discussing immunohistochemistry, maximum parsimony, or the curse of dimensionality.
The curse of
Johnny
dimensionality.
Depp movie, I think.
That's a real thing. It's a real thing.
Look it up.
So yeah, she was cool.
All right, thanks, Bob. So another study comparing low-fat versus low-carb diets.
Here we go, yeah.
Okay.
Let's do it.
Here we go.
Yep. And begin.
So whenever we talk about, there are certain topics, and we've been talking about so many different things for 13 years now. We know the triggers, right? We know which topics have an emotional response.
And milk.
Yeah, milk is one. But anything to do with food, people get so emotional, righteous.
Aspartame.
There is a moral dimension to food that is amazing. Plus, when you talk about dieting, everyone thinks they're an expert. And
what works for me, right?
Yeah, right. Like the anecdotes will flow. Ooh, and I get it. I totally get it. But because I spent my whole life eating. I have a lot of knowledge about my own eating. But okay. But still, in order to make generalizable recommendations for the public in general, you know, obviously we're looking at studies statistically and then trying to apply them to individuals. You know, we do need statistical data, not just people's anecdotes, just like anything in science, right? And this is a complicated area of research because this is one of those areas of research where there's no individual perfect study or even like really home run out of the park definitive study, because it's tough to do that kind of study in this topic. And therefore, we're kind of inferring from different ways of looking at the data. So this was a clinical trial. They randomized 609 participants to two groups, what they're calling a healthy low-carbohydrate diet and a healthy low-fat diet. The macronutrient distribution, so it was 48% fat, 30% carbohydrates for the low-carbohydrate group, and 29% fat, 45% carbohydrates for the low-fat group.
Steve, is that considered extreme or is that moderate?
I don't think
so. No, that's moderate.
That's moderate.
It's not extreme at all.
They told them, guys, when you pick a diet that you can live with, pick that forever, and don't make it extreme. So that's why those numbers might seem not too restrictive, because they were specifically told to make it so that's something that they can live with.
I've seen 90-10 ratios.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's extreme low. Diets. Or ketogenic. You know, that's really low. So in any case, then they followed them for a year, which is a good duration.
Wow.
It's considered relatively long-term. It's not super long-term, but it's long enough that you get over the short-term effects. And they found that – so both groups lost between 5.3 and 6 kilograms over the year with no statistical difference between the groups. So basically no difference in weight loss between the healthy low-fat and the healthy low-carb. So this is an interesting piece of data. Again, it's not definitive, partly because of the fact that this was self-report. It's always a limiting factor. Yeah. It's like – if you guys ever hear the saying, fast, cheap, or good, pick two? Research is often like that too. It's like, do you want a large study? Do you want a rigorous study? Do you want a detailed study? You know, pick a couple of those, but it's hard to get all three. It's hard to get really detailed data that's highly controlled on lots of people. And so there's a lot of studies out there that picks two of those, basically. It's like you could have a lot of people, but it's self-report or it's observational. You have a few people where you rigorously control every detail and you analyze it and it very rigorously, right? So this is a large study that was randomized, but it was based on self-report. But even having said that, though, that's not, that's a weakness to these studies, but it's not a fatal flaw, in my opinion. So more importantly, though, let's look at the research in general, right? And this is where, whenever I write about these kind of topics, it creates a huge controversy. I know I'm going to get lots of comments and people are going to have very strong opinions and accuse me of lots of awful things because they disagree with my interpretation of the evidence. But nobody really has an answer to my actual interpretation. They always attack a straw man, then I finally get them to understand what I'm saying, and then it never seems to go past that. But anyway, let me tell you, the key is to understand the different types of evidence. This is where I find that the public struggling to understand a complicated topic, often the science communication breaks down. So for example, there are lots of animal studies, right, where you let animals eat like high fat or low carb or whatever, either calorie restricted or ad libitum, which is as much as they want to eat. And it does show that there are some advantages to low carbohydrate diets, but that's in rats or mice. And that data just does not translate to humans. So I just don't, I don't find rat data very compelling when it comes to diet. I just don't think that we have a, you can compare humans to rats when it comes to that. Definitely the human data trumps the animal data when it comes to that. The other type of evidence that a lot of people, especially in the low carb group, cite are basic science studies. They start to talk about insulin and the hormonal regulation and hunger and fat storing and the energy homeostasis. And that's all interesting. But the major fallacy that they make, which I've said in multiple other contexts as well here and on my blogs, is that you cannot extrapolate from basic science to complex final clinical outcomes. We just don't know enough to do that. If you get one thing subtly wrong, you can come up with the opposite conclusion of what is actually true. So it helps us understand plausibility and it helps us understand how the whole system works, but we need to check it against clinical trials where we're looking at net clinical effects. An analogy I came up with to try to understand this is, let's say we're talking about how fast your car will go, right? When you're driving a car, how fast will the car go? Well, it's basically a function of how much you're applying the gas versus the brake. And then people are like, wait, whoa. So yeah, what about the coefficient of friction of the brake pads and the ratio of fuel to oxygen and the gear ratios and all that stuff? It's like, yeah, all of that is at work. All the physics and the engineering of cars is, but that's in the background. The driver doesn't need to know the coefficient of friction of the brake pads. All you really need to know is that you apply the gas to go faster and you apply the brakes to go slower. And I think it's the same thing with diet, like knowing about all of the various mechanisms of homeostasis of energy control in the body is useful for scientists and for complicated questions like disease states, et cetera. But for the average person, you don't need to know all that stuff. And it doesn't really, there's no direct applicability of it. What you need to know is calories in, calories out. That's what you need to know. And that's the predominant effect when we're talking about weight control. That's the predominant effect. How many calories are you eating? How many calories are you burning? And all the other stuff, it has a negligible effect. And that's what the clinical research shows. There may be a decrease in hunger in low carbohydrate diets short term, but that peters out at about 6 months. So the low carb tends to have a slight advantage, although it may be statistically significant in the first 6 months. And then, both groups usually tend to gain weight after 6 months, and the advantage of the low carb tends to go away. In some studies, it stays statistically significant at 12 months. In some, it doesn't, but it's always small and it's always getting smaller over time. And usually people are gaining weight in the latter half of the study. So there isn't a really clinically significant difference in macronutrient ratios when you're looking at weight control. We're not talking about other stuff. So don't say, what about health and blah, blah, blah. We're not talking about that for right now. We're just talking about weight.
So Steve,
yeah,
calories in, calories out. Is that it or what?
That's it. Yep. That's it. That's what the clinical research shows. If you want to lose weight, you have to consume fewer calories than you burn. Then there's a related question. Well, what about increasing the burning part? What about exercising more? And yes, exercise is great. You should be exercising on a regular basis. But the thing is, if you're going to try to like have a 500 calorie a day deficit in order to lose a pound a week, which is basically what that is, you have to like jog for 3 hours. It's like you can't yeah. really do it. You can't unless you're training for the Olympics, unless you are an extreme athlete or you have a lot of time on your hands. You can't, it's not really practical for most people. And sometimes it might be not physically possible.
Yeah. I really learned that this past yeah. year when I was trying to lose weight. I was doing probably 5 or 6 hours of cardio a week and I'm very disappointed with my weight loss. And I finally realized that if you look at the calories you burn from exercising and the calories you take in from eating, the latter swamps the former.
Yeah,
if you really want to make a dent on the calories that you go through, your deficit of calories, you gotta control what you eat. You gotta minimize what you eat in one way or the other. Portion control, whatever. Exercise is great. Don't never give that up. It's an adjunct to weight loss, but it's not the main way you're going to lose weight. Your fat.
Right.
So there's another type of research that impinges on this question. And that is looking at people who have lost more than 20% of their body weight and kept it off for more than 5 years, right? So you look at people who, by those criteria, have been successful in making a permanent long-term change in a good direction in their weight.
So rare. Right? Was it 5%? The standard percentage?
Yeah, it's low. It's pretty low. But
why is it that low?
If we look at those people, because people, I think, are, because it's hard, because there's all sorts of cultural forces working against it.
Yep.
And people are using the wrong strategies because there's so much misinformation in the diet and self-help industry. But if you look at the people who have been successful, there are consistent patterns that predict success or that correlate with success. What are those patterns? Again, this isn't definitive either, because this could be, you know, random correlations, or they could be indirect markers or whatever. But again, if we look at the data we have, these are the signals that we have. One signal is it doesn't matter what your macronutrient balance is. So low carbohydrate dieting does not predict long-term success or correlate with long-term success. Of course, there are individual people out there who will tell you that it was successful for them, but that's anecdotal. If we're looking at data statistically, no. Mm-hmm. Statistically, those are people who are going to lose weight anyway, and they just happen to be doing that, and it's, you know, but there's no statistical correlation. There is a slight advantage. There is a statistically significant advantage to a low-fat diet, though, however, in terms of long-term weight control.
Really?
Yeah, we don't know why, but that multiple studies have shown that. I don't know that that signal is strong enough for me to say, yes, use a low-fat diet. I think, you know, if you look at all the data, it basically doesn't matter. But if anything, in terms of long-term success, low-fat has an edge over low-carb. So low-carb kind of has a short-term advantage. Low-fat has a long-term advantage. Both, I don't know that they're that clinically significant. Getting regular exercise, that's a huge factor. Having some mechanism of estimating your caloric intake, that has a huge benefit. Most people underestimate their caloric intake. They underestimate how many calories they burn exercising. Yeah. So if you, and you don't have to obsess, you don't have to count calories, you don't have to go crazy, just pay attention, track what you're eating, because you will underestimate it if you're just going by your gut feeling, right? Just track it somehow. Weigh yourself on a regular basis. You need the feedback of the scale, because otherwise you don't know if what you're doing enough. But if you weigh yourself and you adjust what you're doing, the scale doesn't lie, right? The scale doesn't lie.
I wish it did.
It's important feedback. If you use the feedback of the scale, it predicts success.
Yeah, but weigh yourself once a week, though. Don't go every day, because your weight will vary quite a bit depending on time of day and water weight.
You're just tracking your bowel movements at that point. But yeah, just weighing yourself once a week is probably the best approach. Use social forces to your advantage. So have your friends and family support you. And also, if you could find a dieting buddy, that's hugely successful too. Because even when like spouses are not trying to lose weight, when their spouse is on a diet and losing weight, they'll lose some weight too. There's a lot of social forces that go along with that as well. And do a diet that you could live with for the rest of your life. Do a sustainable diet.
Okay. Key.
Yeah, that's key. And recent study also showed that slow and steady wins the race. Don't try to lose weight fast. The people who were able to keep the weight off the longest were people who lost a small amount of weight each week, but did it consistently every week. So like you're much better off losing a pound a week consistently than losing 2 pounds 1 week and nothing the next week, et cetera. Because I think that for that predicts somebody who has made permanent, moderate but reasonable changes to their habits, to their lifestyle.
Right.
They're not actually dieting. They've just made changes to their lifestyle. Yeah. And I think that's why diets
basically
fail. That's
really it. Don't diet. Yeah. Don't diet anymore. Yeah. Just don't think of it as a diet. Don't treat it as a diet. Make a permanent change.
Make permanent changes to your habits. Right, exactly. And then your weight will tend towards
new homeostasis.
New homeostasis, right? More healthy way. But it's hard. Jay, again, you asked, why do most people fail? There was also a recent study which showed that when you do lose a lot of weight, your body interprets that as famine. And then it kicks into, oh, okay, I just survived a famine. I better pack on the weight for that next famine that's around the corner. And so your hunger goes up. That's why you have to push through that by exercising, by making those permanent changes to your habits, by tracking your weight on the scale so that if it starts to creep back, you realize, okay, whoa, I gotta, you know, whatever, reduce my portions a little bit more. I've let it creep back up again. It's still hard. Again, there's no formula that works for everybody. It's still hard, but these, at least that's what the evidence shows. At least this is the evidence that we have. Obsessing over, you know, macronutrient ratios doesn't really correlate with a useful long-term strategy of weight loss. But man, people hate it when I say that. You know, there are some people who just can't get over this whole notion. It's like it really has become almost a religion to some extent, yeah, the low carbohydrate thing, you know. And you see it every time I write about it.
This is a great example of, are you going to follow the science or not? You can't pick and choose what science you want to follow. I mean, you know,
right.
you, if you're feeling any cognitive dissonance, study yourself, because I doing this show for the last 13 years, you know, I've had so many things happen that rubbed me the wrong way and just what I thought was right and wrong. And I had to like just stop myself from thinking I know better than the experts.
Yeah. But it's hard. We're compelled by stories. So when someone else says, I did X and I lost weight, we're like, oh, really? I should do X. You know, that's just the way we're wired that way. And our own anecdotes are gospel. Now, whoa, forget about it. Like, oh man, I did this and I lost weight.
You?
It worked
How
for
can
me,
you
man.
Never convince yourself otherwise.
Right. So that's the hardest thing. That's the hardest thing for a critical thinker or a skeptic, is to trump their own anecdote, to say, well, this was my experience, but it's not really supported by scientific evidence. So I guess it was just quirky. I guess it was just one of those things. Maybe I was going to lose weight anyway. I was just ready to lose weight, it's because I ate less or because whatever, and it wasn't the low carb. And it's confirmation bias that I think that worked. I mean, that's hard to do, but that's what
you got to
do.
Very hard to do. And that'll never be the core of a marketing scheme. I'll assure you of that.
right. Absolutely. But, doesn't sell a lot of books, you know? You could summarize the scientific evidence that at a level that people need to know to apply it to their own lives. That's a long article. You know what I mean? Maybe it's a pamphlet, but it's not – you don't really need a book length of information for people to know how to live a healthy life with and manage their weight reasonably. You know what I mean? Again, most people who don't have any huge medical issues, right? And obviously there are lots of medical situations like diabetes, et cetera, where that adds a lot of complexity to the diet. And then you might need to consult with a nutritionist, you know? Celiac, that's an extreme one. You have to be on a gluten-free diet. But even just like, you know, being diabetic, or you may have GI issues, or you may have heart disease that you're trying to manage, or kidney or liver. There's all kinds of things that you might need to add a lot of complexity to your diet. But if you're just an otherwise healthy individual who's just trying to lead a healthy life and manage their weight and not have high cholesterol, you know, eat a lot of vegetables. Don't eat too much. Exercise regularly. That's pretty – if you just do that, you're 95% of the way there. Everything else is diminishing returns. Seriously. Eat a bunch of vegetables. Don't overdo anything. Everything in moderation. Exercise regularly. Portion control. You're there.
I got something to add to it, Steve. I've actually been blending a lot of vegetables. I'll use kale and spinach. Mm-hmm. And a little bit of fruit juice as the base. I'll put some protein powder in there. I mean, if you really don't like to eat vegetables and you want to, you know, desperately want to get them down,
yeah,
you
could actually help me make, out, man.
Well, it's not hard. It really isn't hard. I'm serious.
I love vegetables.
Me too. I love eating vegetables. But after a workout, I would have made a smoothie probably from that morning. I have it in the freezer and I'll have that, you know, as like a post-workout type of thing. But if you hate vegetables, you can sneak them into your stomach by doing this, by taking them, you know, you have to have a good blender because it's got to chop this, you know, it's got to liquefy the leafy vegetables. But, you know, you take some kale and spinach. I fill the blender up about halfway with that, put some fruit juice in, I blend it until it's liquid. Then I put a cup of protein, you know, a serving of protein powder in there, whatever flavor you like. I use vanilla. Then I add a handful of frozen berries from Costco, a couple of frozen strawberries, a whole frozen banana. And maybe if I have like a mango mix type of stuff, that's all frozen stuff from where I get it at. Like I told you, I get it at Costco and it's really inexpensive and it's easy. And you just annihilate it in the blender. And you
what's really funny is that even you guys can't resist the anecdotes. Can't resist.
Yeah. Well, what? That's
I know.
An
I had no anecdotes.
I'm just saying, we have to talk about what we do. It's just we're compelled to do it. When it comes to food and eating.
I mean, but
because eating is so social, it's so personal, it's so social.
But Steve, this is a story about me eating vegetables. You know what I mean? Like it is.
I know, but it's the details are just do what works for you. And in terms of like how you do that, that's you have to find out what your issues are. Like, do you overeat in the morning? Do you overeat in the evening? Do you snack all day? Do you have one big meal? What is it? Do you have a weakness for sweets or what is it? Do you not like to eat vegetables? Different people have different challenges to having that reasonable, you know, healthful diet. That's not going to generalize to everybody. That's what's working for you. Now, what's funny? Let me just give you my little anecdote. This sounds funny because kale is such a faddish superfood, but I love kale. Yeah. I love it.
What?
It's like one of my favorite salad ingredients now. Oh, it's great. I love dark green leafy vegetables. I love salad.
Loved kale? You eat green food?
No, I've always loved salads, but kale wasn't a thing, you know, up until recently. And now it's like, it's like maybe every other day there's a kale salad at my cafeteria at work. So I've been having it and I love it. I love the texture. I love it. It's crunchy. I love the taste. It's good. It's really, really good.
It's great to put in the blender because it doesn't have a very strong flavor. So it doesn't screw up. Yeah. It doesn't screw up.
And like it's nutrient dense.
Yeah.
It's a dark green leafy vegetable. So it's not any better than anything else out there in that category.
A dark vegetable, a dark leafy vegetable is way better than like
it's good.
Iceberg lettuce, which is basically
water.
You know, don't even waste your time.
I agree. Yeah, the dark lettuces are better. Like romaine's better than iceberg. And it's good to throw spinach into your salad. Absolutely.
And the kale, varied colors, right? I mean,
throw it in a variety of colors. As well.
Arugula. Yeah.
I don't like arugula because it's too bitter, but
too bitter. I like bitters. I like the bitter ones.
No, I'm a super taster. I still like kale. But anyway, not because it's a superfood, just because I just happen to love that kind of leafy vegetable. I love the texture. There's something about the texture that I love.
Okay, when I hear superfood, I think someone's scamming me on something.
It is. So the superfood's a scam. There's no superfood. It doesn't exist. It's a total scam. They'll say kale is being sold as a superfood. It isn't. It's just another dark green leafy vegetable that's good for you. Because, you know, these things they're high in nutrients, they're low in calories, they're good for roughage. And if you have a lot of that in your diet, you're going to be good. You're going to be fine. You know, then your mommy was right. Eat your vegetables. That's basically the only,
dieting advice that you need.
Gosh, it's like when I hear commercials about ancient grains. Eat your ancient grains.
Yeah,
like,
right?
Really? Give me a break.
All right. The other day, I had a quinoa lentil bowl.
You did not.
I did.
You are so.
You're making that up.
I'm not. I felt guilty because it was so, you know, I don't know, so crunchy. But it's just, you know, whatever. I love grains. I love lentils. I love lentils.
Yeah,
but
lentils are
just that it was just what was available. You know, like I didn't order it because it was you know a thing. It's just that's what was on the menu that I liked. It was grain and lentils. What's not to love about that? But I did feel almost a little silly ordering a quinoa lentil bowl.
Quinoa is a great Kung Fu name. Quinoa.
Kung Fu name.
All right, guys, let's go on. All right, Evan, tell us about the extinct MOA. I wrote down in my notes, extinct, no MOA.
Yeah, this is a neat news item that I happened across, written by Sharon Begley. Sharon Begley writes for Newsweek and Stat News, and she wrote a piece which got picked up on lots of aggregates in the last day or two, and it's titled "With DNA from a Museum Specimen, Scientists Reconstruct the Genome of a Bird Extinct for 700 Years." Cool. How could you not open that article and read that?
Whoa.
So here's what she writes. Scientists at Harvard University have assembled the first nearly complete genome of the little bush moa, a flightless bird that went extinct soon after the Polynesians settled New Zealand in the late 13th century. The achievement moves the field of extinct genomes closer to the goal of de-extinction, bringing vanished species back to life by slipping the genome into the egg of a living species, a la Jurassic Park. Neat. Now, the moa were 9 species of flightless birds native to New Zealand. There were 2 of which who were exceptionally large, Deinornis robustus and Deinornis, well, I can't pronounce the last part.
Dino-mite.
In any case, some of the larger species of moa reached 3.6 meters, that's toe to head, outstretched, and they weighed as much as 230 kilograms. Very heavy. Estimated that...
Yeah, they're basically just, they're walking food.
And no wings, which was... Yeah.
Well, they had wings, they were just flightless.
Flightless, right, yeah, just little things, yeah. Little things on the sides of them, but effectively didn't really do much of anything for them. The moa population in 1280 was estimated to be 58,000, but it didn't take all that long for the humans to come along and kind of put an end to them. Now, this work by the Harvard researchers has not been published in a journal yet. However, it was posted on a non-peer-reviewed website called BioRxiv. So we have to wait and see if any peer-reviewed journals take it and run with it. But regardless, the Harvard team's research has experts in the field really buzzing about it. Morten Erik Allentoft of the Natural History Museum of Denmark, who's an expert on moa DNA specifically, among other extinct genomes, he called it a significant step forward. And Beth Shapiro of the University of California, Santa Cruz, who led a 2017 study reconstructing the genome of the passenger pigeon, which we've talked about on the show before, she called it super cool because it gives us an extinct genome on an evolutionary branch where we hadn't had any before. Mm-hmm. And they got the samples from, as the headline implies, a museum species from the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto. And they had a very nice toe bone from the little bush moa. They extracted the DNA, and then the scientists were able to slip the DNA into the egg of a living species. Now, that's harder than it sounds. The DNA itself is usually badly fragmented, like described as a shattered wine goblet. Think of that. And DNA decay begins within days of death. So you're already just days into it. It's already starting to fall apart. But with modern technology and the scientists' brains behind it, they're able to put the Humpty Dumpty puzzle back together again. They used high throughput genome sequencers to assist in the very long strands of nucleotides to put them back in order. Now, high-throughput sequencing has revolutionized the field of ancient DNA by facilitating recovery of nuclear DNA for greater inference of evolutionary processes of extinct species than is possible from mitochondrial DNA alone. And that was from the abstract of the study. But the tricky part is figuring out where these pieces actually belong on the genome, on which chromosomes and in what order. And to do that, Harvard's Allison Coulter and the rest of the team took their 900 million nucleotides, which are scattered across millions of DNA pieces, and tried to match them to specific locations on the genome of the emu, which is a close relative of the moa species. And they were able to get roughly 85% of the genome in the right place. So they used the emu as the blueprint to guide them, and it did wonders for them. 85%. So we're able to still, they're still short 15%, but still working on it and trying to put it all back together. But it's been a difficult process, but nonetheless, they've taken some extraordinary steps along these lines. And then putting it into an egg is also a challenge. It's not like Dolly the sheep, who was cloned using a mammalian egg. I mean, we're talking about a bird egg. And the researchers are still trying to deal with that hurdle. And they said that there was a recent walk-around, a possible fix, that succeeded in chickens by basically putting the genome into embryo cells that become eggs or sperm. And they think that that sort of approach may be able to get them to achieve their goal of getting this done, getting that DNA into that shell inside the egg, and boom, there you go. We're going to have moas walking around on the earth again.
Boom, baby.
Perhaps.
Did they say, like, how long they think the whole process is going to take?
They didn't give us a timeline. They didn't have a 5 or 10 year period or anything like that. But only that with the modern technology, it's come so much further than from 20 years ago, leaps and bounds. But no prediction as to when exactly these things will come to full fruition. It's not just this species. Obviously, passenger pigeon is also being worked on. We've talked about the woolly mammoth before also. They're working on the DNA sequencing of the woolly mammoth and, of course, the Tasmanian tiger from Australia. But 700, a species that was extinct 700 years ago, that seems very doable.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
It would be awesome.
All right, thanks, Evan.
You're welcome.
Bob, tell us about superatomic semiconductors, or is it semi-atomic superconductors?
Superatomic 2D semiconductors.
We're in
the news recently. They were created for the first time, potentially showing the feasibility of an entirely new class of materials with completely tunable properties, which is the key part there. So fascinating. So this is from a recent issue of Nanoletters, authored by researchers at Columbia University, the University of Angers in France, and the Italian Institute of Technology in Italy. So for me, though, the big tech here, it was the super atoms. It's just so fascinating. I remember reading about them years ago, kind of forgot about them, totally dropped below my radar. And I think they have an amazing future. So they are technically molecules, but you can think of them as kind of a weird fusion of elemental atoms and molecules. Maybe you can call them atomcules, perhaps. Hey, I think I like that. So a superatom, all right, so look at it this way. A superatom is a cluster of atoms that behave like a bigger version of a completely different atom. That's it in a nutshell right there. It's a bunch of atoms, kind of like pretty much a molecule, but imagine a bunch of atoms that are arranged in such a way that they behave like a bigger version of a completely different type of atom. So now this happens because the atoms in the cluster essentially pool their electrons in this sort of super shell of sorts around the core of the atoms. And if you know chemistry, you know that since the shell of electrons determines the chemical properties of an atom, so this cluster then can behave like a completely different type of atom. So that is very, very sweet. So this whole idea of superatoms was discovered in the 1980s when colleagues at the University of California found groups of sodium atoms sharing electrons. Now, joining these superclusters together, though, hasn't been easy. It took until, I think, 2015 or 2016 was when I first found articles that they were actually creating pairs and triplets of these superatoms. And now, though, they've made two-dimensional sheets of them. So that's kind of the big breakthrough here. Now, the two-dimensional material science is young. The most famous example, of course, is graphene. But as much potential as that material has, it's structurally very, very simple. And I mean, we've talked about graphene before, and we know the potential of graphene. It seems like an amazing kind of super material, but it is incredibly simple. But it doesn't have to. You could make two-dimensional sheets of materials that are much more complex and could do many more different things than even graphene potentially. So the sheets of superatoms, or flakes as they call them, are much more complex. They perform tests on the material of its electronic and optical properties, and they feel that this approach could be successful in creating other very different types of two-dimensional materials, with very, very different types of tunable properties. So here's a quote from the paper. The author said that it's the first member of a new family of 2D semiconductors whose structure is built from superatomic building blocks instead of simply atoms. Such structures will expand the conceptual design space for 2D materials research. So what can we expect in the future from this type of stuff? So we can expect, I believe, new types of building blocks at the nanoscale with magnetic qualities that we can change to make ever faster computer processors and sensors. So yeah, so for a lot of this stuff, we're going to see better and better, you know, ever improvement in electronics. Which is always a bonus. We always love seeing that. Maybe we'll be able to finally create super dense memory storage, but this time using magnetic moments instead of electrical charge. That's just the kind of stuff that we may be able to accomplish with these superatomic structures. And even more efficient fuel could come of this. And that may sound like, well, wait, how could you get better fuel from this type of thing? So imagine this. Now imagine you've got aluminum powder, which actually isn't very safe. Don't mess around with aluminum aluminum powder because it releases a huge amount of energy very easily when it interacts with other elements. So that's why you're not going to be putting, you know, aluminum powder in your car. It's just way, way too dangerous. And I'm sure there's probably some other issues. But imagine if you take the aluminum powder and you surround it with superatoms that mimic a noble gas like helium or xenon, and then you could just pump it right in your car because whenever it interacts with anything else in the environment, it's just going to be like it's interacting with something innocuous like xenon. So that's just a tiny little taste of what our superatomic future can be like if we continue to make advances such as this. So I'll be tracking this. This one's pretty cool.
Yeah, that sounds awesome.
All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Yeah, last week I played this noisy. Any guesses?
Is the key noise the like da 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 da?
Yeah, the Morse code.
Yeah, it's not the white noise in the background. It's definitely the beats.
So is that avian? Is it a bird of some sort?
Is it technological?
It could be, but it's not. So here's a few guesses. Here's a few guesses. This is again like this cool theme that I've been finding lately is it could be anything. You can think of lots of things in nature. You know, an astronomical noise is perfectly cromulent. But no, here's a guess from Tim Adwell. And Tim said it took him back to his boyhood. He said, sounds like a katydid call, only instead of massive sleep-deprived ensemble that he's used to, this is an isolated critter, a solo artist, if you will. That was a fun guess, Tim, but that's not correct. I thought a notable guess was from Paul Appel, and Paul said, sounds like the disk drive of a Macintosh 512K enhanced. Damn straight it sounds like it. It does sound like a hard drive, which I find to be really cool. The winner last week, now this is a 90% winner. This is Kevin Riggs. Kevin said, I'm pretty sure that that's a clownfish.
Whoa.
And he said, I know this because you guys reminded me to watch Blue Planet 2, which I thought was funny. It's not a clownfish, but it is a fish. And this is close enough because the clownfish is using the same mechanism. This is actually a drumfish. And the drumfish is using its bladder to make the noise. I guess they communicate for some reason or make these noises maybe when they're in distress. But even more interesting. So Michael Topepper, I think that, or Toper. Michael, you should tell me over email how to pronounce your last name. I like Topepper, though. Michael, actually, he used to be he's a retired U.S. Navy officer, and he had this really cool site of all these sounds that I guess the Navy was collecting, or these are just, you know, what do you call it, nautical sounds of the sea, okay? Listen to the beginning of this audio track that I didn't play for you guys.
Fish in the ocean produce sounds in varied ways.
I love it.
The drumfish, for example, produces its sounds by use of a specialized drumming muscle.
I mean,
1965 health class, you know, biology class film.
Right? Isn't it amazing?
You can almost hear the projector spools noise, you know, clicking in the back.
Yeah, the flapping. Yeah. But that literally like was the tone of voice that I grew up, you know, in the 70s watching science videos in school, right? That's what Evan is referencing.
Not even videos, right?
Yeah. Yeah, science films.
Real film.
Real to real in the classroom. I love that. I love that intonation. I love that whole vibe. It gets more interesting. Yeah. As I get older, I like it even more. Just really cool. Very, very, man, that's the 60s, right? It's late 50s and 60s. So thank you for that, Michael. I thought that was a lot of fun. I have a new noisy for you this week. This noisy was sent in by a listener named The Funky Thumb. And here you go. Right, it is an incredibly short noisy. I'll play it again.
Gotta hear it. The washboard kind of
Or maybe an electrical component to it there.
Guys, if you think you know what this week's noisy is, or if you've heard anything cool this week, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Now, Steve, before you move on to the next segment, because I know what's coming, last week I asked Meatle G, Mr. Meatleg, to email us.
Yes.
And he did. He did. He's still listening, and he emailed us. So,
or E-R-I-C-H, Erish, Eric, Meatleg, M-E-A-T-L-E-G. That's Meatleg. Yeah, so he wrote us in, He says, still listening after all these years. I don't comment on the message boards much, but I always listen. A few notes about how you guys have influenced me over the course of your show. Over the past few years, I have been losing my hearing in one ear due to Meniere's disease, so I don't listen to as many podcasts as I used to since I don't like pushing my luck with headphones anymore, but I still make time for the SGU no matter what. I still remember when I realized how powerful of a platform podcasting was when Perry passed away. I listened to podcasts while I was walking to the train station. It usually took about 15 minutes, so it was great exercise. I left my apartment right as I started listening and heard the news, and I couldn't believe it. It was an extremely long walk that day because I felt as if I had lost a friend. Podcasting is a very personal medium, I think, because it feels like you are sitting in the same room on a conversation that you have been invited to, even more so than any other kind of news or radio show. I didn't feel that weight again until my brother passed away a few years later. Listening to you all talk about the passing of your father made me realize that every conversation with one's children really counts. I resolved to make more of an effort to stay off my phone when I am at home so I can shape my kids more attentively. I recently let my twin boys stay up past their bedtime so that they could see the blood moon eclipse. Cool. When it got fully red about 10 p.m. Japan time, one of my six-year-olds said, "It's not moon, it's Mars." I was surprised that I had never thought of that myself. What an interesting perspective our kids can give us. At my day job this year, someone on our health team gave a presentation about putting pressure on meridian points to relieve stress. Oh. I gave him feedback after the fact, letting him know I thought that it was important to stick to health topics that are supported by science. He pointed me to the Japanese Wikipedia page that says that the World Health Organization has recognized the efficacy of acupuncture. Sigh, I knew exactly where I was going to head to find the actual story on the issue and immediately headed to SBM, the Nest blog, and Neurologica to find Steve's article on the WHO acupuncture report. Thanks to all the great resources you guys put together, the hardest part was explaining it in Japanese. And then in parentheses, I am not a native speaker. Thanks for shout out. See you in Alpha Quadrant 6.
Yeah.
Awesome. He listens to our science fiction show, Alpha Quadrant 6. Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. Gosh. So that was fun. I mean, we don't always just read emails that aren't really a question, it's just feedback from our listener. But it's fun, I think, every now and then just to hear the kind of experience that our listeners have with the show.
And Eric's been listening since the beginning. I mean, in the first few months, I think we started to hear from him.
Yeah. He sent us some videos of him with his sons as well, which is really cute.
Yeah, so thanks for taking the time to write. I mean, I do like that aspect of podcasting, and a lot of people have said that to us as well. And I listen to other people's podcasts, and I agree. It is very intimate because the person's in your ears. You know, they are in your head. And it's like it's more intimate than video. Like video, you see that you see that they're not with you. You know what I mean? And
yeah,
in video, like there's just different with just voice, they could be sitting next to you. You know what I mean? Just the reaction to it, I think, is more visceral in a way.
Yeah,
I agree.
And you feel like they are talking to you. You know.
Well, Perry and I used to listen to radio shows quite a bit, talk radio shows of all sorts of genres, and that's exactly what. And this was way before the podcast. This was exactly what we felt at that time as well, but certainly even more so with podcasting nowadays. I agree with that sentiment.
All right, thanks again, Meatleg. So one more quick email. This is a question, but we could chat about this. I have a friend who believes almost all the conspiracy theories out there, from the moon landing is a hoax to 9/11. No matter what I say, he always has some comeback. Is there any one site that I can use as a reference to help me out? Help, Bob from Mexico City. Well, Bob from Mexico City. So we get this question a lot. That was just a very succinct way of saying I have somebody who's a friend, a family member, whatever, who is a dedicated conspiracy theorist. What can I do about that? Unfortunately, the short answer is not much. I mean, what the research has shown is that there are some people who are opportunistic conspiracy theorists, meaning that they will believe in a conspiracy if it otherwise supports their ideology or their narrative, their belief system, whatever. So, for example, you might believe in one conspiracy that is in line with your political beliefs. But then there's a subset of conspiracy theorists, people who believe in conspiracy theories, who believe every conspiracy theory, even mutually exclusive conspiracy theories. There's just some, you know, they believe in the conspiracy theory for the sake of it being a conspiracy, not for the details or for any other ideological reason. And of course, whenever we talk about this, again, the common question that people or feedback that people give us is, well, aren't there real conspiracies? Yeah. But when we are talking about conspiracy thinking or conspiracy theories, first of all, we're talking about grand conspiracies, not plausible conspiracies, but ones that are so huge that they would collapse under their own weight. Multi-generational, multi-governmental, you know, conspiracies that would involve hundreds or thousands of people keeping impossible secrets over years or decades, you know, that kind of thing. But also, it's not so much about the conspiracy itself or the idea of a conspiracy. It's the thought process that conspiracy theorists use to maintain the conspiracy, right? It's always about the process. And conspiracy thinking can be a hugely pathological, uncritical process. The problem with conspiracy thinking is that it's a self-contained belief system which insulates itself from external reality and from refutation. Like to give you an example, any evidence that would seem to refute the conspiracy was manufactured as a false flag or as just part of the conspiracy. And the absence of evidence that you would expect to exist to support the conspiracy is being hidden, is covered up by the conspiracy theorists. Yeah, or suppressed. So there is no evidence or lack of evidence that can count against the conspiracy when viewed from inside the conspiracy. Right, you could explain away anything, and therefore you're completely cut off from evidence.
It's not falsifiable, and therefore
it's unfalsifiable. Absolutely,
and therefore
that's the problem. If you're engaged in that process, that is the conspiracy theories or the conspiracy thinking that we are talking about. And there's lots of other aspects to it as well, but that's the core. That is the key. If someone's really trapped in that, you can't. Going to a website and getting evidence to give them is not going to help because they're immune to evidence. You may still want to be well informed so that you could, you know, have a conversation or defend yourself. And I don't know of any one-stop shopping for that. You just need – there are good references for each individual conspiracy. You just have to find them. You know, certainly I've written about a lot of these different conspiracies on the neurological blog, but it's certainly not an encyclopedia of conspiracies.
If our TV show was actually okayed, we could have just referred them to the Conspiracy Nation, which would be – we'd be in season 3 or 4. But we can't do that now, can we?
If only there were a TV show. But yeah. But don't think that you're going to actually have a gotcha. Like you're going to like – oh, I could prove that the earth is round. Yes, you can, but it doesn't matter. Trust me, it doesn't matter. You have to address the conspiracy mindset itself, and that's a much harder nut to crack. The best you could do is try
Nigh
to
impossible.
Inoculate people against it, right? You want to understand it so that you don't fall into it in the first place. But once you're enshrouded in that conspiracy narrative, you're a true believer. You know, it's like trying to get somebody out of a cult. There's no formula for that. I'm not saying it's impossible. It's never impossible. And if it's somebody close to you and you want to spend months, years chiseling away at that, that's probably a worthwhile investment. But you got to have patience. You've got to have a lot of patience. It's going to be frustrating. Conspiracy theorists could be exasperating because you're hitting your head against the wall over and over again, and it just doesn't matter. They will wiggle out of any evidence, and they'll laugh at you about it. They're like, oh, you naive sheeple. I mean, come on. Obviously, this is a false flag operation. So it's like, you're like, really? There's no evidence? There's nothing I can say that will make any progress? And just be prepared for that, because that's the way it is.
Welcome to our world.
Welcome to our world. Right. Yeah. All right, guys, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fictitious, and you guys have to guess which one is the fake. We have 3 regular news items this week. Are you guys ready?
Yes.
All right, here we go. All right. Item number one. According to a study by the CDC, that's the Centers for Disease Control, the most common cause of animal-related deaths are due to deadly encounters with farm animals. Item number two. Researchers have produced the first commercial perovskite solar cell with efficiencies equal to silicon-based solar cells, but only 1% of the thickness. And what I mean by commercial, meaning like it's ready to be mass-produced and marketed. Item number three, scientists report a new method for creating graphene on the surface of a variety of organic materials, including food items, allowing for the creation of edible electronics. Jay, go first.
All right, so this first one, according to a study by the CDC, Center for Disease Control, Steve, just so you know, the most common cause of animal-related deaths are due to deadly encounters with farm animals. The animal-related death could be humans as well, because it doesn't say, it just says animal, and we're animals.
No, this is not humans.
All right, so non-human animals.
Farm animals. Oh. Okay.
Can't so, farm animals.
Farm animals are killing other animals, and they also could be farm animals.
No, these are human deaths due to animals, due to non-human animals.
Yes, that's what I thought. Okay. Oh boy, Jay, you really...
Right? What? Did I do something wrong? The most common cause of animal-related deaths are due to deadly encounters with. So farm animals are killing people.
Yes.
Do you remember, Steve, that we came up with a parody of the movie Jaws called Snout, and it was about a wild boar? Because more people get killed by wild boars than by sharks every year. So we said...
I believe.
And there was one line I remember from the movie that we were writing at the dinner table with a bunch of friends. And we said, he's gone under the tractor. Instead of going on the boat.
No, it should be called Tusk.
Tusk.
Okay.
All right, so sure, makes you know, sense. Farm animals, they're mean. They know they're on the cutting block, you know. All right, next one. Researchers have produced the first commercial perovskite solar cell with efficiencies equal to silicon-based solar cells, but only 1% of the thickness. So why do we care? What is that substrate less expensive? Is there something novel about it, Steve?
Well, it would be cheaper.
I believe it. I believe that one to be true. All right, this last one. Scientists report a new method of creating graphene on the surface of a variety of organic materials, including food items, allowing for the creation of edible electronics. Jesus. I'm still not past edible underwear. Now we've got edible electronics. Okay, why would we want to eat electronics?
That's a good question.
I could just see some weird shit going on there.
Yeah, literally.
The first one about the animals, you know, I've never heard or read anything about it, but it just wouldn't surprise me because of just how many animals there are being farmed. And, you know, there's got to be a lot of people involved. I don't know. But this last one just seems so obvious that Steve would think, you know, hey, why would we be eating this stuff? I don't know. I just think the first one about the animals is true. So I'm going to say this one about eating graphene and electronics is false.
Okay, Bob.
This is good, man. I don't know where the hell you grabbed this shit. the animal deaths, I could buy that. Maybe I shouldn't. Oh, well. So then let me go to number three, the graphene one. This one makes sense. I mean, so what? They have methods for creating graphene. Now they have another method that can deposit it stably on an organic material like a fruit or whatever. And that's fine. And that's fine. And the fact that this allows for the future creation of edible electronics, so what? I mean, they're not doing that now. Then we're not near the point where we're going to deposit a layer of graphene and do something really cool with it, because it's just not at the level where it's going to have some display on it or something really interesting. So that one is
I'm going to correct a misconception of yours just because you often make this
read
error.
Into-
yeah, you what? You like you miss keywords and then you have a complete misconception about what's going on. It's not depositing graphene on the surface of the organic material. It's creating graphene on the surface of the organic material.
Aha.
Understand the difference?
Well, I mean, I just assume that it would be some sort of deposition process where
it's
just,
not.
Well, I clearly don't know how the hell they're doing this. But still, I think my point.
Or why they're doing it.
I think my, okay, fine. I think my point stands, though, that just because they could create it on something organic doesn't mean that you're gonna be watching TV on your damn Apple, your pear. But that's So, oh, shit, I have no idea. This, and then, all right, let's go to two, shall we? The perovskite solar cell. Hey, that would be awesome. 1%. That's damn good. But that seems, we have to come up with the law of, like, since I haven't seen it, it's probably fake. I went through a bunch of items, news items today, and that thing would have stuck. I mean, I think I would have seen that. Unless sometimes you pull, like, oh yeah, this is actually 2 days old, and I could have missed it because I was mainly looking at stuff that came out today. Blah blah blah. I think I gotta just put my dime down here. I'm gonna go with the perovskite. Fake news.
Okay, Evan?
Well, for the animal one and the deaths, I was always, for a very long time, under the perception or misperception that bees or bugs cause the most deaths in people because of their, you know, toxic, and people have allergic reaction to bee stings and these sorts of things. But I don't know. That apparently will farm animals outweigh the insects. God, there are so many insects on the planet, many of which cause people a lot of pain, discomfort, and death. So I don't know about that one. And then the first commercial blatherskite solar cell with efficiencies equal to perovskite. Is it okay that I don't know what perovskite is?
Yeah, of course.
Is that some kind of sin? Is that a scientific sin? Because I'm ignorant.
It's a little surprising, but go on.
Okay. This 1% of the thickness? 1% of the thickness. Can I get a hint as to how thick a silicon-based solar cell is?
It's thicker than that.
100 times.
It's 100 times thicker. Thank you very much. Okay. Well, I think if that's the fiction, then that's going to be the problem there. It's the thickness issue, obviously. And the last one about the creating graphene on the surface of a variety of organic materials. I don't understand why. What's the purpose for it? And then creating. So it's plucking molecules out of the air and boom, here's your graphene on the surface of the food and stuff. That sounds absolutely fantastical, which means it's probably true. And therefore, I have to go with either farm animals or perovskite, which I know nothing about. Shoot. All right, Bob, don't lead me astray, please. I'm going to follow you on this one entirely. I'm going with the perovskite.
Wow.
Solar cell. I'll say that's fiction.
Wow.
Okay.
Please.
Jay just got dissed. So you guys all agree on the graphene one, huh? So I guess we'll start there. Scientists report a new method for creating graphene on the surface of a variety of organic materials, including food items, allowing for the creation of edible electronics. You guys all think that this one is science, and this one is science.
All right.
Oh, okay.
Done well.
Okay. So what, this is a proof of concept and then move along kind of thing?
No, not at all. This is huge.
So how did they create
it? You know what they're doing,
it?
Bob? Have you heard about this?
No, I haven't.
It's laser-induced graphene, LIG, laser-induced graphene. So they can shoot a laser at the surface of toast.
And change the carbon into an
apple.
Graphene layer?
Yes, exactly. They create a graphene layer out of the material of the item itself.
What?
That's cool.
With a laser.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Holy crap. That's...
So you could print circuits on toast or whatever. So... What?
Yeah, but you also do it on a chip. Get a like a carbon chip.
Right. Why does it have
any
to be?
Any carbon precursor can be converted. That can be converted into amorphous carbon. Can be converted into graphene using this multiple lays method.
Wow, what the hell, man!
It could be used. Yeah, it could be make it on cloth, on paper, on cardboard, or on food. It's not just food. It could be like other material, like wood.
So why would we consume, and what's the purpose of consuming this?
So let's say you want for diagnostic studies, or you want to track, you just want to track food from farm to stomach, you know, or you somehow figure out a way that if the food starts releasing the breakdown products of spoilage, this graphene layer will change color. So you could tell, oh, that's spoiled, you know. So this is speculation. These applications are speculation, but that's the things that they're talking about. So
that's
tracking
wicked.
or signaling for spoilage or contamination or
sounds
whatever.
Sounds expensive.
Well, but yeah, you know, the laser method is not expensive, though. That's the point.
Start you treating just, all these. That's a lot of food you got to treat to track all that stuff. I mean, it's interesting.
Yeah.
It's really interesting.
Yeah, we'll see. Yeah, I mean, economic plausibility is another issue, but so yeah, it's one of those things. It's interesting technology. The idea is very interesting. The fact that you could make graphene just out of wood, you know, just with a laser is fascinating. How exactly what the applications will be? That's hard to predict.
I just don't. I'm not even sure like how it.
Yeah, feeling it.
I believe you. I believe you. I'm just not sure how it functions.
What do you mean how it functions?
It's got to be hot, right?
How does the circuit function? How does it work on there?
Oh, graphene is a conducting material. So if you could print a circuit, and then there you go, you got a circuit.
But what if it's on something that's wet?
I don't know. you're beyond my reading on this. But you could like put RFIDs on stuff by just printing it in graphene, you know.
Yeah.
For example. Anyway, we'll see. This is like one of those things we'll have to check back with this in 10 years and see if it went anywhere.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. All right, let's go back to number one. According to a study by the CDC, the most common cause of animal-related deaths are due to deadly encounters with farm animals. Jay, you think this one is a fiction. Bob and Evan, you think this one is science.
Barely.
And this one is...
Say it.
Science.
Yeah.
Science.
Yeah. Evan, yep. High five.
I was,
farm animals, number one cause of animal-related human deaths.
Not bugs, huh?
Yeah. Mostly like horses and cows, you know, just because they're big animals and they could crush people easily. And Jay, you're right. There's a lot of them. There's a lot of interaction with people. I think people may feel inappropriately at ease around these massive animals.
Yeah. Beasts of burden.
The next most common category, what was the next highest category of animal-related deaths?
Bee stings.
Bee stings, Hymenoptera.
Okay.
That's correct. Yeah, that was number two. Yeah.
So which is it, bees or Hymenoptera?
Hymenoptera. Yeah. All of that means that researchers have produced the first commercial perovskite solar cell with efficiencies equal to silicon-based solar cells, but only 1% of the thickness is the fiction.
I'm kind of bummed.
So I don't know if you guys have been following – have you guys have been following the perovskite solar cell hubbub?
Clearly not.
But it's one of those technologies to watch, but we are not anywhere near a commercial application yet. For actual solar cells, we could be 20 years away. It depends. There's some significant problems that have to be solved. There was a study, again, one of those, oh, look, we made an incremental improvement in this one aspect of it, but we're not quite there yet, in the lab, but maybe it'll scale up to commercial, whatever. You know, it's like one of those situations. So the advantage of perovskite is basically any crystal structure based on calcium titanium oxide, right? So it's a mineral, and it's abundant and cheap. So this could reduce the cost significantly of solar cells. It's also very thin enough to be flexible, right? So you could have thin, flexible, cheap solar cells.
And great. High absorption.
So when they were first developed, they had really low efficiency. But over the last 5 years or so, they've gotten the efficiencies up to almost the level of the silicon-based solar cells. So they're now in the commercial range in terms of efficiency. But there's a couple of problems with the perovskite. There's one of them is a deal killer. The deal killer is it's not stable in air. That's kind of a problem. That's a deal killer, you know. So
kind of a safety concern, I would think.
Well, it just breaks down. Just the structure breaks down. So the solar cell would not function for very long. Usually they break down over months, you know, like, oh, so 3 months from now, my solar cells are kaput. You know, that doesn't work. So a lot of research has been focusing on how to stabilize it. And that's what the new research was. It was a study showing like, oh, look, we figured out how to make it a little bit more stable. And what they showed was that it kept 80% of its structure after several months. So, okay, that's good, but that still may not be good enough. I mean, we want solar cells that are going to last for 20 years, right?
That'd be nice.
Yeah. Steve, I'm looking at a study here published in June 2017. Says that it no observed degradation over 1 year.
But there's always a caveat, though. There's always a killer. So. Yeah. like, so the other thing is, like, what are you doping it with? So the current perovskite solar cells that they're working on incorporate lead. That's a problem because lead is toxic, and that means there'd be a lot of lead getting into the environment. So they're looking for alternatives to lead. And so you're going to see studies like, yes, we've made it more stable by sandwiching it in between gold and platinum or whatever, or we replace the lead with this other thing, magnesium, which is going to be more abundant. So that's lots of that research is going on, but no one's put it all together yet. No one has come up with the formula for a perovskite solar cell that has the efficiencies that we need, that has the stability that we need, and that is cost effective and doesn't have anything massively toxic in it. So we're not there yet.
But, when you say it like that, this was obviously the fiction.
Well, yeah. So and while we're making progress and there may be some applications of perovskite coming down the road, but solar cells, we're in that 10 to 20 year range, And again, like even these studies, Bob, that like the one you're referring to and the current one, these are laboratory fabrication processes. They're not large scale commercial fabrication. So that's always that final piece that you need, right? Well, how much will it cost to crank the stuff out in sheets? We're not there yet. But this is one to keep on your radar, perovskite solar cells. This might be the next generation of solar cells that will, and this may be, how we're making incremental improvements like every year, like we're getting a little bit more efficient, a little bit cheaper,
Yeah.
But this may be one that puts us on a different path, that where we have a drop, like a significant discontinuous improvement in features, not just incremental. But we'll see. We'll see. We don't know. We do not know yet. It might be like the hydrogen economy and it's just insurmountable problems that we never figure out. Good job, Evan and Bob. Evan, you totally rode Bob's coattails.
All right. Thank you, Bob.
Somebody's got to do it.
Sorry, Jay.
Well, for your penance, you have to give us a quote. Give us a quote.
Where misunderstanding dwells, misuse will not be far behind. No theory in the history of science has been more misused and abused by cranks and charlatans and misunderstood by people struggling in good faith with difficult ideas than quantum mechanics. That was written by Sean Carroll.
Yeah, Sean Carroll. Which one?
which book?
No, there are two Sean Carrolls who are science communicators.
There's a second Sean Carroll?
Yeah.
All right.
Probably the physicist.
Sean Carroll from his book, The Big Picture on the Origins of Life, Meaning, and the Universe Itself.
Yeah.
And a good friend of the SGU. We appreciate Sean very, very much.
Yep.
Do you agree with that sentiment quantum mechanics?
Quantum mechanics is definitely on the short list, and it's very time dependent. So a couple hundred years ago, it was electromagnetism. 100 years ago, it was radiation. Now it's quantum mechanics. It'll be something else 50 or 100 years from now. So for now, yes, it's quantum mechanics. Absolutely, quantum woo all over the
quantum
place.
Quantum woo, absolutely. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you guys for joining me this week.
Sure, man.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org. where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.